Well, my guest tonight at the big table was once the leader of the white supremacist movement here in the Chicago area. Kristen Piccolini grew up in Blue Island and for a short stint in Oak Forest. Blue Island's a working class neighborhood on the southwest side of Chicago. He was a self-described loner who had a hard time fitting in until he found a purpose. Piccolini rose to power as the leader of the neo-Nazi skinheads in the late 80s, early 90s, mainly through white power punk music, which he played in bands like Way and Final Solution. But as he grew older into his 20s, Piccolini used family and a record store to escape the violent world that he in part created. He rehabilitated in 2010, and he co-founded the not-for-profit Life After Hate. And last year, he wrote the book Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. And he joins me at the big table tonight. Christian, thanks for being here.
Justin, it's my pleasure.
So let's talk about your life. I mean, you grew up, I mean, your life and your roots are in Blue Island.
Yeah, I was there my whole life, even though for part of my life I actually didn't live there.
Yeah.
I grew up there because my grandparents in part raised me.
What was Blue Island like? Talk about it in the 70s, 80s.
Oh, wow. It was a really great place to live and grow up. You know, back in the days when your parents would let you out on the street till midnight when you were 12 years old and, you know, you came in when the street lights went off. A large portion of Italians from my mother's village in Italy moved to that area. They even set up a church in the patron saint's name. It was just a really cool place, very working class place to live.
And you talked about sort of going back and forth and stints because you spent some time in Oak Forest. But what that did in reading your memoir was just give you a little bit of a loner. You didn't have friends in Blue Island. You didn't have friends in Oak Forest because you were split in time.
Yeah. You know, my parents were Italian immigrants who moved to the U.S. in the mid 60s and, you know, they had a hard time fitting in. They fit in very well into this Italian neighborhood of Blue Island. But then they decided when I was born to move to Oak Forest because they wanted kind of a more upscale place to raise me. But what that did for me was create a huge problem because the Italian kids then thought I was a sellout and I was too American for them. And the American kids saw me as kind of this really weird Italian kid.
A minority, really.
Yeah, yeah. I was the minority. Yeah. I ate Nutella sandwiches and my parents spoke a different language and we had these weird customs. So I never really fit in and I got bullied quite a bit growing up.
You know, when you talk about, I mean, there, you know, when you got back to Blue Island and you talk about trying to sort of assimilate and get in with the High Street Boys and,
yeah,
and the, you know, he talked about in the book, there really was this sort of like this moment where you were trying to, at all costs, to fit in, to find a community because it just wasn't afforded to you.
Yeah, you know, and I think that that's really no different than what every young person goes through. It's that struggle for identity, that struggle for community, and you know, having this sense of purpose that you have absolutely no idea how to focus. So I was trying to fit in. I really wanted to be somebody. Even as a shy, introverted kid who was, you know, shorter than everybody else, I just wanted to be one of the guys.
And one of the guys, you know, in Blue Island was, like you said, I mean, it was an Italian-American neighborhood, and yeah, it wanted to stay that way. There's about, yeah, you know, it's the southwest side of Chicago, but it's still a Chicago neighborhood, and it's boundaries with some South Side neighborhoods, African American neighborhoods, Beverly, other places.
Sure.
Talk about the idea of sort of being territorial, the boundary of, yeah, Blue Island.
Well, the area that I lived in was the Italian portion. It was on the east side, which was kind of the lower middle class side. And there was a huge population of Italian people that all knew each other back from the old country. So I didn't really hear the racism. I didn't see the racism, but there was kind of this inherent, you know, not my neighborhood kind of thing,
mm-hmm,
where, you know, I didn't hear anybody outwardly speaking, you know, slur words or anything like that. But there was this feeling that, you know, this was the Italian neighborhood and they didn't really want anybody else coming into that area.
And how did, I mean, as kids, I mean, that sort of became, you know, part, I mean, you kind of talk about it in the book and it's no different than I think a lot of Chicago neighborhoods or even suburbs where you sort of, you know, you kept people that weren't part of that circle out.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's a fear factor, right? We're scared of what we don't know. And especially people coming from kind of a different country and not even being accustomed to the customs of this country to have people that they absolutely have nothing in common with, or so they think. It was a fear thing. They were scared of what they didn't understand. And I think most people from very strong ethnic communities may feel that same way.
There's definitely, I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you think about the way that Chicago is even sort of categorized or always in a very sort of positive way, a melting pot, city of neighborhoods.
Yeah.
But there are neighborhood boundaries. And we, sure, saw this in Chicago in so many ways. We've seen it when, you know, a lot of violence in Bridgeport, you,
sure,
know, and other places like that. You know, for you, when was it the first, I mean, because that it seems to be somewhat of a normal protect your hood.
Mm-hmm.
But when did the sentiment that it was more about, you know, sort of the idea of white supremacy or the idea of racism, when did it start to creep in?
You know, I fell in with America's first neo-Nazi skinhead group, not because of the racism, because I wasn't raised that way. My parents weren't racist. They were often the victims of prejudice when they came to the U.S. I fell in because I was seeking that community. I was looking for that identity. I wanted power when I felt the most powerless. And, you know, being an ambitious young person, they focused my sense of, you know, doing something important into something very bad. So the ideology came a little bit later. It was really
right.
just about
it was youth belonging. Culture. It was belonging, but it was also punk music. There was a little bit like the sort of things
subculture.
It was a subculture.
Yeah, right. And I was 14 years old, and I was looking for something, and this guy who I met walked across my path and convinced me that there was a better way, and that I wouldn't feel powerless, that I wouldn't be marginalized, that I would be powerful and respected. And I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll do that. What do you want me to do?"
Well, let's take a quick break, and we'll get into the story of Clark Martell and the other sort of neo-Nazi skinheads that you fell into and that ultimately became the leader of. Christian Piccolini is in studio with me. He is a reformed American neo-Nazi skinhead. The memoir is Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He's going to be speaking in Skokie at the Ethical Humanist Society on March 5th. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back more with Christian. Stay with us. My guest tonight here at the big table, Christian Piccolini. He is the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He is going to be speaking in Skokie at the, Ethical Humanist Society. That's on March 5th. Really, this is a story of reform rehabilitation of being a neo-Nazi skinhead.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked right before the break about sort of the idea of being a 14-year-old kid. And the thing, Christian, about this book, which is crazy, is it's 300 pages of life before you were 20.
Yeah.
I mean, to talk about where you began at 14 years old, talking to a neighbor who lived across the street to where it ended when you're 20, 21 years old, it's an amazing read for 6 years of a very turbulent lifestyle and life. Yeah. Christian, Clark Martell comes over. He gets out of the Trans Am,
Firebird,
comes over to you and changes your sort of outlook on life.
Yeah, I was standing in an alley at 14 years old in 1987 and contemplating my life like most teenagers were. And I happened to be standing in the alley smoking a joint. And this Firebird came roaring down the alley and it stopped. And the guy got out with a shaved head and with boots. And this was 87. Nobody really knew what a skinhead was. And he came over to me and he grabbed the joint from my mouth and he crushed it with his boot. And he looked me in the eyes and he said, "Don't you know that that's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile?" I was 14, man. I didn't know what a communist was. I didn't know if I'd met a Jewish person. I didn't even know what the word docile meant. I knew nothing about politics whatsoever. But this man, after talking to him for a while, who was twice my age at the time, he promised me paradise. And, you know, that might sound familiar for all different types of stories of, you know, whether you're joining a gang or, you know, flying to ISIS from middle America. He really promised me that I wouldn't be marginalized anymore, that I would be somebody. The racism didn't even register with me. It wasn't important to me. It was about belonging to this group and him saying my problems would go away. And
what was next for you? I mean, after that point, after he says the problem's going to go away, I mean, you're 14 years old. I mean, you go back to school, right? I mean,
it was the summer. So I think it was the summer between eighth grade and freshman year. And I had that summer to think about it, to ride my little red bike up and down the alley, to go buy them cigarettes and get them, you know, beer, back when you can still do that without, you know, having to present an ID. And I got close. They drew me in and I started to dress like them. I started to listen to their music and I started to repeat the words that they said. And slowly that became my narrative. Actually, rather quickly, it became my narrative.
Well, you're 14 years old. And the narrative, I mean, the words that are used in the book, I mean, are just vile. I mean, you're sort of dumbed down, sensitive. This is some serious, this is white power at its most serious.
Yeah.
You talk about that because, you know, there's one thing to have this sort of ethos and for Clark to come over, but the guy that recruited you, I mean, he's talking about an entirely, I mean, he is really at the forefront of a white power neo-Nazi movement in the late 80s. It was unprecedented in the United States.
It was unprecedented. He was America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader. And the neo-Nazi skinhead movement was born in Blue Island on the southwest side of Chicago in roughly 1985, 84. And here I was in 87 at 14 years old, and nobody had seen skinheads on, you know, Geraldo yet or Oprah. It happened that year, like 87 and 88, when people started to recognize it. But this man just, you know, I wanted to be like him. I didn't want to be me. I hated who I was because I felt very abandoned by my parents because they were, when they came to the country, they wanted to work to support their family. I didn't see it that way. I just felt abandoned. I didn't, you know, I know that now. So I started to do things to scream for attention, and I ended up hating other people because I really hated myself. I was projecting my own anger and insecurities onto other people so that I wouldn't feel that pain anymore.
Well, in the book, and you talk about, you know, Clark, the man who was the forefather of the American neo-Nazi movement, went to jail.
Yes.
He got a sentence, and it left a void. And you at 15, 16 years old?
Yeah,
stepped into that void.
At 16 years old, after Clark had gone to prison for a really violent hate crime against a female member of his same group who they saw at a bus stop with a black man, they went to her apartment and beat her, pistol whipped her, and left her for dead and painted a swastika on her wall with her own blood. And one of America's first hate crimes, if not the first, I believe. And they went to prison. A bunch of people went to prison. So here I was, this 16-year-old kid, with 2 years under my belt in America's first neo-Nazi skinhead movement, and there was this leadership void. And being ambitious, being, you know, trying to be entrepreneurial like my parents were, I stepped in and I became very intoxicated with the power, or what I thought was power. It wasn't real power. It wasn't real respect.
So what was the job? The job was to not only continue the teachings of Clark, but to be sort of a minister of propaganda, but also... Yeah. To enact violence.
Yeah, no, it was largely about propaganda. We were a very effective marketing arm of the movement at that time. And I started bands to be able to draw people in because of that, and it worked very well. But there was absolutely violence, a lot of street violence, actually. And not so much, funny enough, maybe not funny, but it wasn't against minorities. It was against other white people. It was people in anti-racist gangs, anti-racist skinhead gangs, that we would just end up fighting each other over and over. But our main mission was to spread this propaganda, conspiracy theories about how Jews controlled the media and finance, how, you know, we were that diversity was a code word for white genocide, and that if we didn't protect ourselves, the white race would die.
You know, it's. I mean, like I said, it's a tough read. There's times when there's some very sensitive material and sensitive language in this book because you lived it. Yeah. And at 16 years old, I mean, it's amazing to me because as time went on, you were able to not only do the things we just talked about, propaganda, even starting the bands, but that your power, you gained more power and you protected the turf. It was not unlike what we have witnessed with gangs and other things in the city of Chicago. It's very similar, but it was under the idea of white power.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was just the thread that bound all of us together, was that ideology. But it was for the exact same reasons that young people joined gangs. There was a lack of opportunity. There was a sense of power and, you know, masculine kind of adrenaline going. And I wrote the book in the language that I would have spoken at 14 or at 16 or at 18. So that was intentional.
And that's striking. You know that as a reader. It's not like I'm thinking, oh, this is Christian writing it back. I mean, it gives you a better understanding of who you were at 15, 16 years old.
Yeah. I mean, this wasn't as much of an apology book for me, although I'm very shameful about the things that I did. It was really about putting it out there as genuinely as possible so that people could see how dangerous it was for a young person from a good family who had a lot of love around him to go down a really bad path and end up hurting other people. And then eventually realizing that what I had learned and what I had taught others was not something that was positive for the world.
Before we get to that, because we will get because we got you for the hour, you know, The part that really struck me was as a 16-year-old ambitious leader of a pretty new American movement, a white supremacist movement, you were able to not only organize and recruit locally here in Chicago, but you became a focal point, if not a leader in the country. I mean, you were having meetings with you know, people from Minnesota, from Alabama, from North Carolina, wherever it was. But the idea of really sort of being a networker at the age of 16.
Yeah. You know, I would even go as far as to say international, because I was, you know, there were people trying to set up meetings with me from Libya that represented Muammar Gaddafi, that wanted to potentially fund, you know, our revolution against the common enemy, which we thought was the Jewish people. And, you know, luckily I didn't participate in that one because it ended up being a sting operation by the Canadian intelligence community. But, you know, it was really, it gave me this intense feeling of power. And respect, but it was not real power. It was not respect, because I was really destroying myself and everybody that I touched.
You had, and your relationships got worse. Your family, your parents, it was a complete meltdown. Yeah. It was hard for you to keep relationships with anybody. A lot of the people that you did have friendships with were under the guise of this kind of white supremacist movement. I mean, for all the things that you entered into this movement for, it still seemed to not sort of quench that thirst.
No, it was like drugs, right? I mean, you get a taste of it, it feels pretty good for a little while, and then you need more and more until it kills you, and it kills everybody around you. And I had to give up everything that was important in my life, just like a drug addict, or just like an alcoholic, or just like, you know, anybody who joins a gang, because I wanted to adopt this new family, this new identity. And I had to give up my real family. I had to give up my real friends and my real hobbies and all the things that I loved just to be able to hate. And it was a really, it was like a disease that spread really, really quickly. And thankfully was able to pinpoint it before it took me over, like most of the people that I knew who went to prison or ended up dead.
Kristen Picciolini's in studio with me. He's the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He's going to be speaking in Skokie at the Ethical Humanist Society on March 5th. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. When we come back, you know, music played a big part of this. You founded a couple bands, white power punk bands. A lot of the communication and the network was set up by obscure music, punk music that was a rallying cry for white power. Let's talk about that when we come back. And then let's also talk about your rehabilitation. I mean, what it takes to get out of the American skinhead movement. I mean, it's pretty intense. Kristen Picciolini in studio with me tonight. He's my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight at the big table is Kristen Picciolini. He's the he's the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He is a rehabilitated, reformed American neo-Nazi skinhead who wrote the book, from Blue Island. And as you said earlier in the show, I mean, really, the Blue Island, Illinois lays claim to, you know, the start of a neo-Nazi movement here in this country. I mean, back in the mid-80s.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's enough's enough. The hair metal band and the birthplace of the neo-Nazi skinhead movement.
Those are the two
in the U.S.
You know, it's interesting, and I want to bring this up because we talked about, you know, we're going to move on with the story because I want to get to the point when the breaking point for you. Mm-hmm. But you know, Mary texts in. She's got a great question at 847. She says, as a teenager, deep down inside, when you were alone and not around the rest of the group, did you truly believe the things that you were being taught?
I had doubts every day about the ideology. Every day. You know, I wasn't raised that way. It wasn't a foundation of who I was. It was something that I learned how to do and eventually unlearned how to do and, you know, took accountability and responsibility for the actions that I took. And I've spent the last 20 years of my life really trying to pull out, I'm still pulling out the weeds from all those seeds of hate that I planted, you know, 30 years ago. And which is why I've dedicated the last, you know, 20 years of my life to making sure that other young people don't go down the same path that I did.
You know, it is interesting because I think about the book and the stories that you tell, and, you know, there is this kind of idea of, you know, a lot of, you think of people who are overcome by racism or intolerance, they may have had something personal happen to them.
Sure.
I had an uncle who couldn't stand African-Americans because his relative was mugged
right
by a black man.
Right.
in your case, that's not necessarily what it was. I mean, it wasn't just sort of like, you know, I hate gays, or I hate blacks, or I hate Jews because I have this personal experience. This is all just ethos. This is just something that was taught to you down at 14 years of age.
Yeah, no, I mean, the worst thing that happened to me was a couple of weeks after that alley meeting when I was smoking a joint and I met Clark Martel. I was riding my little red bike to Little League practice, and three black kids jumped me, beat me up, and stole my bike. And that made everything fall into place and make sense. I could blame everything now in the world that was going wrong on black people and Jews and everybody. That gave me license to do that. And it's the most ridiculous notion, because we know white kids steal bikes. We know Latino kids steal. I mean,
and in Blue Island, I mean, there's a little bit of, in the 80s, Blue Island, people are jumping people for their bikes.
That's just Blue Island. I think that's what Blue Island teenagers did back then. I mean, it really took an almost very benign incident to confirm everything that I'd been confused about and that I'd been being fed now for a couple of weeks to legitimize that idea. And all of a sudden it became me against them.
You know, Clark and Blue Island and your experiences shaped you, but also punk rock music shaped you, white power punk rock music. I think of... is it Screwwork? Is that
Screwdriver?
Screwdriver.
Yeah, no, it spoke to me.
So this was a punk band from Ian Stewart and the guys from London or from Britain.
Yeah, it was. And England's or the world's most popular white power band, the forefathers of it, really.
And so they were that became sort of a way. I mean, the way that you would start to get tapes and you'd be able to listen to the stuff, and the lyrics were a lot of protecting the Great White Way.
Yeah.
And a lot of sort of xenophobic policies in Europe at the time in the 80s. I mean, this stuff became the rallying cry, and you were able to be almost a distributor here in the States and in America, and a way to take over what Clark was doing to get that music in the hands of potential neo-Nazi skinhead.
Music is a really powerful tool, and it doesn't matter if it's being used for racism or for love or for drugs or for whatever you want. It speaks to people. It brings you back to a certain time. It invokes emotions. It does all kinds of crazy things. So that music spoke to me. It was very noble. Its lyrics were about protecting, you know, your culture and being a Viking and you know, just this sense of honor it instilled in you. But that was also propaganda teaching you what we're calling now fake news, right? Mm-hmm. It was all about conspiracy theories. It was all about, you know, blaming others for the problems that you were experiencing rather than taking accountability for what might be the mess that you created. And it gave me license to be violent. It gave me license to be angry. And it was a very powerful tool that I recognized early. And that's why I started one of America's first white power bands.
You did, yeah. And talk about Way, the band that you, what was, I mean, you were a singer. So talk about, like, what drew you? What was it all about, sort of being a conduit, being a minister of propaganda?
You know, I didn't know how to play an instrument, so I just decided to be the singer of this band because I was very influenced by this music that was coming from England and from Europe, and it made me feel powerful when I was on stage. So I would write lyrics denying the Holocaust or talking about, you know, the proud white legacy of our Viking ancestors.
And all stuff you didn't really know anything about.
I'm Italian. Like, I don't know very many Italian Vikings, but at that point in my life, I thought it was important. And, you know, it was a great tool to get young people together. It was like...
Come to the show.
Come to the show. Yeah. Drink beer. There's girls. It was a great way to convene people, young people, and bring them into a message. It was a great tool.
And you had the ability, I mean, with the band and the band after that, to really move into a white power punk music lexicon. Like, you not only playing with the bands that were the only bands here in the States, but you were invited to play, and you have a story of playing in Germany to thousands of neo-Nazis who you're on stage, and there it's Heil Hitler back and forth. I mean, talk about that. I mean, you reflect in the book about the power of that, but how does that memory, that thing that happened to you, how does it resonate with you?
You know, being a 17-year-old person and being in America's first white power band to ever leave the U.S. and play in a foreign country to 4,000 people, imagine being a 17-year-old kid who's insecure, who has low self-esteem, that's only bolstered by this false sense of power, now standing on a stage in front of 4,000 skinheads from all over Europe. And they're chanting your name. They don't speak your language, but they're singing your lyrics. And they're all buying you beer. And you're a hero in your own mind. At 17 years old, at that moment, it was the pinnacle of my life. Mm-hmm. I never thought I could be smarter, stronger, better, nothing. And that just kept feeding me with this, you know, this power, I guess, this false sense of respect. And I played on that. And that's what kept me in, because ideologically, like the person who texted in, I had questions every day about the ideology. I question it now whether I even believed any of it to a degree. I was certainly violent because of it. I'm responsible for the acts that I committed and for all the people who I've, you know, co-opted their lives and who knows what happened to them. But at that time, I thought I was doing the right thing. I really thought I was saving the world. I thought that what I was doing was, you know, contributing to the greater good. But I always had these moments where I was like, really? Is that really what, you know, I want to do? Does that make me happy? Is that, you know, how is that affecting the other person? I had these flashes of empathy throughout those 8 years. And that kind of came to a head during a violent act when, you know, I was in a McDonald's with some of my friends late at night. And we walked in and there were these three black teenagers standing in line. And I, you know, I loudly said, "This is my effing McDonald's, get out." And we chased them out. And as we chased them, one of them pulled out a gun. One of the black teenagers pulled out a gun and started shooting at us. And the gun jammed. And when we caught this guy, we beat him brutally. And this is a moment that still comes up in my mind and I think about quite often. As I was kicking him, I looked in his eyes and I thought, this could be my brother. This could be somebody that I love or care about.
Yeah, younger brother, yeah.
Yeah. And how is this affecting this person's family? I had this connection during one of my most violent moments. And that was the last time I committed an act of violence. I really started to then, that was the catalyst that really allowed me to question what I was doing and why I was doing it.
After you had a child, mm-hmm. and you were 19, 20 years old.
19.
You started to question your role mm-hmm. in the neo-Nazi skinhead movement. Especially in Blue Island, you gave more power to other people. You started to get work in construction. Mm-hmm. You opened up your own record store. You know, it's interesting because as you went up and you're at that peak in your mind with this false power on stage in front of, you know, people who don't speak your language but are shouting your lyrics back to you.
Yeah.
The way down and out was not easy. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of, not only sort of, you know, all the things that you held dear, how tough you were,
yeah.
how much power you had, all that stuff started to sort of come back to bite you in the ass.
Yeah. I was faced with this ideology that I didn't believe, because when I held my child, I finally had something to love. And all I had known for 8 years was hate, even for myself. So I knew that wasn't what I wanted to do, but I also knew that it was going to be extremely difficult to give up everything that I had built during those 8 years. I mean, my whole identity was that movement. Every single one of my formative teenage years was spent in that movement.
Expelled from schools.
Six of them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you,
one of them twice.
Yeah.
And here I had this, you know, this loyal family that had followed me and done anything I wanted them to do. And I had this power and this purpose, and I had to give up all of that. And when I gave that up, because I started to meet the people that I hated and I started to humanize them, when I opened the record store, people would come in to buy the other music that I was selling besides the white power music. Mm-hmm. I was selling hip hop and punk and heavy metal. And I began to meet the people that I hated for the first time in my life. And after a while, after they kept coming back, even though they knew who I was, they kept having these personal conversations with me. And I started to realize that, you know, we had the same fundamental needs, joys, fears, hates, and we needed each other. I bonded with them when they felt pain. And when I saw the gay couple with their child, I knew that they felt the same love that I felt for my own.
And in a way, you became a little bit of the enemy of your own movement.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when I started to receive compassion that I least deserved it from, when I least deserved it, that's what made my change. But it also pitted me against the people that I was closest to. I became the ultimate traitor at that point when I decided to walk away.
Kristen Piccolini is my guest tonight. He's the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. Really his story as a teenager, being in the beginnings of the neo-Nazi movement here in America, and how he has rehabilitated. We'll come back and, you know, we'll I want to wrap up your story and your rehabilitation. I want to get your thoughts on what we're seeing today. I mean, alt-right movement, so many people talking about white supremacy and white supremacists in office. And it's a lot of the threads and trends and narratives that are in this book are things that I have noticed in the last year.
Well, you know? That's because we started it 30 years ago.
Kristen Piccolini in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Kristen Piccolini. We're talking about his book, Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He's going to be speaking in Skokie at the Ethical Humanist Society on March 5th, talking about his role and leadership of a neo-Nazi movement, skinhead movement here in Chicago, in Blue Island, Illinois. You know, as we sort of wrap up, I mean, there's Life After Hate. I want to talk about that because that's really sort of the that's the sort of peace, not-for-profit organization that you founded. You know, a lot of what we talked about, your family, you know, moving away from the ideology, but also in a situation, and you mentioned it about, you know, when you were having that violent incident and you thought about your brother. Your brother was a big part of your life because a lot of the things that you lived through and turned into who you were, your brother experienced as well.
Yeah. You know, and when I walked away in 96, I tried to run away from my past. I didn't want to really talk about it. I tried to make new friends and I moved and all kinds of stuff. I didn't have the courage to face it. So I tried to outrun it. And then I met a man who, convinced me, and this is somebody who I had hurt, convinced me that I needed to tell my story. So I started to think about it, and I started to tell people, and things started to get better, but I still didn't find the courage to really go public about it. And then one night in 2004, in the middle of the night, I got a call that my younger brother had been shot and killed. And he was in a neighborhood in the wrong place at the wrong time, and somebody was threatened by his skin color. I knew at that point that I needed to really tell my story because I thought that people could learn from my mistakes. And, it was a really tough waking
That's
up.
That's hard. I mean, reading the book and it's structured that way that your brother played a pivotal role in your life.
Yeah.
You know, as being a younger brother who looked up to you and when the points when you really didn't think about wanting to stay in this world and
And he tried to follow in my footsteps, you know, not necessarily ideologically, but he wanted to have the same legacy that I did.
The power, everything, right?
And I wasn't there for him when he needed me, and I blamed myself for a really long time for his death. But I do feel very responsible for every young person because my story is everybody's story, potentially. Every young person is searching for identity. They're searching for purpose. They're looking for that community. And there are people, a lot of people, who will intercept them when they're the most vulnerable because that's what they're looking for, and they'll draw them into bad things.
You said 30 years ago you started a movement. You even talked a little bit about the toxic weeds that are still sort of growing from that movement.
Yeah,
we've seen a lot of it. This talk of white supremacy and even anti-Semitic behavior.
Sure.
We saw more bomb threats at Jewish community centers today. I mean, when you see this stuff as someone who has reformed. Skinhead, neo-Nazi skinhead. When you see this stuff that's being played out in mainstream threads and media, what's your take? I mean, is this real? Is it fake? Is it what's happening?
It's like my life is from 30 years ago is flashing before my eyes again. I can tell your audience right now, 30 years ago, we were involved very heavily in changing the strategy of our movement. We recognized that by waving swastikas and shaving our heads and getting tattoos, we were scaring away a lot of potential members for our organization, or at least ideologically related folks. So we said 30 years ago, we need to stop shaving our heads, stop getting the tattoos, stop marching with swastika flags. Instead, we need to grow our hair, wear a suit and a tie, go to school, go to university, blend in, become a cop, run for office, all these things that we're now seeing today with these, what we're calling the alt-right. And I'm just going to tell your listeners right now, make no mistake, those people who call themselves the alt-right are neo-Nazis. Their ideology is the same. They've just massaged a message and they've made it more palatable for the mainstream masses to accept.
You know, it's interesting, you know, when you talk about that, because you talk about the politicians and you know, the party that's in control. And I don't mean the Republican Party, but the alt-right movement shows a lot of the same things that you're talking about in the book. Also, you know, the neighborhoods that you talk about, Blue Island, Beverly, Mount Greenwood, mm-hmm. I mean, they are strong Trump neighborhoods. And a lot of those people who are from that area have similar thing. I don't want to typecast everybody because that's not the case. But from your vantage point, from the 80s and 90s, there are a lot of people that you were able to recruit from those neighborhoods.
Yeah, I have a lot of former friends, let's say, that went into law enforcement in those areas. And I have a deep respect for law enforcement and for police officers and firemen and what they do. And certainly isn't a reflection on all of them. But, you know, there were members who were skinheads who just, you know, a couple of years after they were skinheads became Chicago cops or went into, you know, different suburbs and are prison guards and things like that. These are, you know, they've definitely infiltrated. I know that there are people who have not changed. They just move from one power structure to another.
They're just seeking power.
Yeah.
You know, Christian, it's interesting because you talked about having that conversation with the man who said, you have to tell your story.
Yeah.
And you said, it's hard to tell the story. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, not unlike just what you just said, as people are seeking from power to power, I mean, so when you tell people I was a leader, I wasn't just a minion.
Right.
I was a leader of a white supremacist movement in the 80s and 90s. How did they react?
You know, that's the reason I started Life After Hate, because of how people react to that, because there was never anybody who had spoken out about it. There had been people who'd spoken out but never provided the support needed for people to leave. Because when people leave an organization like that with a, you know, with an ideology and with a, you know, community atmosphere and a purpose, you have to give them something else. So I started Life After Hate to help people become supported and feel better about themselves so they don't have to use the racism as a crutch. It's interesting. When I work with neo-Nazis, I never talk ideology with them, or I try not to. Instead, I listen because they always tell me the clues on what's missing in their life that led them down that path to begin with. It could be poverty, it could be mental illness, it could be, you know, a grievance of some sort. And I work to fill those holes. And it's funny because when they become more stable, when they feel better about themselves, the racism falls away because they don't have to blame anybody else mm-hmm. for the problems that they had. Now they're responsible for their own problems. And, you know, it's like kind of magical how the ideology just washes away.
It's interesting because these threads that play out really are about a teenage boy who is looking to belong.
Yeah.
And you know, the ideology that in your life was a white power structure that came in that manipulated you and said, hey, you know, this is what you believe. I hear the story and I think about gangbangers in Inglewood, drug dealers on the West Side.
Young girls from Middle America who fly to Syria to join ISIS.
And it makes me think, I mean, you know, from the kid who just got arrested for shooting the 11-year-old girl to, like you just said, the ISIS and what we see with suicide bombings and people who fly. I mean, really, at the end of the day, this is a larger issue than just sort of being indoctrined or mm-hmm. manipulated into an ideology.
Yeah, and this may not be a popular sentiment, but every one of those people you just mentioned was a victim at some point in their lives. They weren't born to be suicide bombers. They weren't born to be drug dealers or gangbangers or neo-Nazis. Something happened. There was a lack of opportunity. There was a lack of leadership. There was a lack of somebody for them to look up to. For some reason, they went down that path. And until we solve the opportunity problem, we're going to continue to see people going down every extremist path imaginable.
Let me ask you a quick question as we wrap up here. And I don't want to get so deep right at the end. But, I mean, you know, for you to think back, to have these memories, to collect them in this memoir, do they haunt you? I mean, do you know, I saw your face when you were telling the story about the violent incident with the kid who shot at you. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think about all the violence and the experiences you were involved in, those memories come back in conversations like this. What does it do to you?
Every time I turn on the news and I hear about a Dylann Roof walking into a church in South Carolina and murdering 9 innocent people, or a Wade Michael Page in a Sikh temple in Wisconsin, or the bomb threats at Jewish community centers, I feel very responsible for that. Because 30 years ago, I put those ideas out into the world, and I know that they are still spreading. And every time I hear about that, I feel as though I helped create that. My music is still out there. And now it's why I've dedicated the last 20 years of my life to really trying to help people find a different narrative and a different perspective.
Christian Piccolini is the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He does run the group Life After Hate, a peace advocacy nonprofit helping people who may have been indoctrined or want to get out of the life of being a neo-Nazi skinhead. He's speaking in Skokie at the Ethical Humanist Society on March 5th. Christian, thanks so much for coming in and being my guest tonight. I appreciate it. Thanks for telling your story.
My pleasure, Justin. I'm going to head back out into the hallway, see if I could catch up with David Axelrod again.
He's out here. Christian, thanks for being here. All right. So there you go. Good conversation right there.